Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. We're down to the end of the year in 2021, and also the end of our fifth year here at Gospel Tangents. Wanted to look back and remember those we've lost this year. It's been a very tough year, and that includes Shannon Flynn. Most of you will probably remember him from his big role in the Netflix series Murder Among the Mormons. But I want you to know that I interviewed Shannon first before he lost his voice. And so I wanted to share a few things about Shannon before we go to the interview. Shannon Patrick Flynn was born in Salt Lake City, Utah on December 27, 1957. The majority of his childhood and adolescence were spent in the suburb of Taylorsville. A lifelong member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Shannon labored as a missionary in the Brazil Sao Paulo South Mission. Shannon and Robin Case were married in Salt Lake City on August 15, 1983. They had four children. Shannon earned a degree in history from the University of Utah. He relocated to Gilbert, Arizona, where he and Robin successfully ran a small business for nearly two decades. He was a lifelong member of the Mormon History Association and a published author. After a three-year battle with lung cancer that eventually metastasized to his brain, Shannon passed away at his home in Gilbert, Arizona, on Thursday, October 28th, 2021. So, you'll remember his very raspy voice in Murder Among the Mormons, and you'll notice his voice sounds normal in my interview. One of the problems was, after he had his lung cancer, one of the nerves got damaged to his vocal cords, and that affected his, that's why he sounds so raspy in the Murder Among the Mormons. So anyway, here's Shannon's true voice, and we'll talk more about him and his time with Mark Hoffman.
I understand from the book that I read, you actually spent some time in jail. Can you talk about that? So what was that all about?
Well, I was incredibly naive. Maybe still am, but I was incredibly naive and unknowing. And so when those bombs went off, and especially the one with Mark, man, I knew him really well, a lot better than almost anybody else did. So I thought I could be helpful. And so I volunteered once or twice to go to the police station and tell what I knew and contribute some information. Well, what I didn't realize is, the police were casting a very wide net on potential suspects, and I got caught up in that net. And so at one point, the police in an interview had told me they were going to go search my house. And so I said, well, you're going to find something there that's illegal. I said, there's an automatic weapon that's an illegal one that actually belongs to Mark, but it's in a storage unit of mine. And so I was at one point arrested for possession of an unregistered automatic firearm, which appears in that's a federal crime under the tax code, strangely enough. And so then I spent 3 days in Salt Lake County Jail and then was able to get bail and get out and then never went back. So in that process, I acquired a defense attorney, and I now, at the time I didn't realize this, but he suggested strongly that I do a polygraph. Well, now I know it's because he wanted to know if I was telling the truth. But it could have been helpful to have me excluded. It didn't exclude me for 1 second, because the police were just, I mean, this was a huge deal and a huge crime. And they were not coming up with, you know, just lead pipe cinch suspects very quickly. And so they were just gonna do what they had to find somebody. And so that became a charge that I could be charged with, though I was never charged with anything to do with the rest of it. But he suggested I do this polygraph, and he knew about David Raskin. So he said, why don't we do this, and then I will help exclude you. So I said, sure. So we drove up to the University of Utah, and I sat there, and like I said, was all rigged up and had six different sensors going and all of that, and $600.
You had to pay?
I paid.
Oh, wow.
I paid. And, I think in my attorney's view, then he believed that I hadn't had anything to do with it. But like to say, the police didn't.
They didn't care.
they didn't care.
So the police still thought you had something to do with it?
Somebody. And they didn't care who it was.
They wanted to hang somebody.
Oh, they had to. And so Lynn Jacobs was looked at carefully. I believe Brent Metcalf was looked at somewhat. I mean, like I say, they were casting that net as wide as they could get it. And it was still, because it all drove from the incredibility of the whole thing. No one believed that any one person could do all of those forgeries and build those bombs and kill those people and all of that stuff. They just didn't believe it. Even if Mark did it, they didn't believe that one person could do it. There must be somebody else involved. And so, of course, they went through the normal police procedures. They found, you know, Confederates, friends, whoever, and they applied whatever pressure they could, because that's a normal investigative technique. Because, you know, often evidence of a crime is not really readily available. A lot of times people are convicted on either witness or complicit testimony. So they were looking for somebody to say, oh yeah, he did it, and I was there, and you know.
Okay, so they put a lot of pressure on you. I mean, did they accuse you of being a co-conspirator or something?
They did a number of things that to this day I will never forgive them for. Never. And this plays into a little bit why, for me, this was difficult to imagine. You will be able to show on this some examples of his handwriting, his natural handwriting from his mission and then from when he was in prison. And when you see those examples of handwriting, and you can imagine that you didn't know that all this had happened, and someone showed those to you, and you say, that is the handwriting of a master forger, you'd say, no, it's not. No, it's not. Because it's awful. The spelling is awful. The handwriting is, it's like a child. And that continues to this day. That is not affected. Well, surprise to all of us, that hand did produce, as he admitted, over 86 different signatures. And then long sheets, not just signatures, two-sided sheets of paper, full letters. But anyway, one of the things that they did is, when I went down to be interviewed, I was just trying to be nice. I ended up going out in handcuffs. My parents came down to the police station to pick up my car. And one of the detectives met them and said, oh, he murdered two people.
You murdered two people?
That's right.
Really? I'll bet that went over well with your parents.
Well. And I'm sure that, you know, the guy that did that to this day doesn't care. Well, that's what I believed. I will not forgive that. And then they did something else too. They did a search of my house while I was in jail. We had a storage unit across the street. We had some baby furniture and a few odds and ends in there. They went in there and they believed they had found the bomb factory. And so an agent from the BATF, unfortunately, I don't know his name right now, but I'll come up with it and I will speak his name out now loud, because that man should be made to be responsible for what he did. They had called the news media. All three Salt Lake channels were out there, Associated Press, Deseret News, everybody. They went in there, had a big pair of bolt cutters, cut that lock, you know, swung open that door, looked, came out. There was nothing there. And that man stood and looked in the camera and said, the bomb factory was there, but it has been moved.
Oh, really?
Straight out lie. So when they said to me, oh, Mark made those bombs, I said, no, you're lying. Because I've seen you do it before. You've done it to me. I got to watch that while I was sitting in jail up on the felony floor. It was very exciting. All of my fellow cellmates were... I was the most famous person in jail that weekend.
Oh, boy. So wait a minute. Let me make sure I understand what you're saying there. So you knew that they were lying about you, and so when they said that Mark was the bomber, you felt that they were lying about Mark as well?
I didn't know anything that that would be true, and I knew they were fully capable of just out and out lying. And like I say, this wasn't, oh, we couldn't quite tell, or there's a little fuzziness, that's kind of a judgment call. No, straight out lie. And not a lie that was damaging, that said that I did something that was horrible, that was completely not true.
Wow. That would have been a very difficult to deal with, I'm sure. Well, so how many interactions did you have with the police? Do you remember? The reason why I'm asking is because I know that Kurt Bench, when I talked to him a few months ago, he said that you, I think it was the day of the bombing, I think it was October 16th, the second day of bombings, I guess I should say, that you and Kurt went to the police station and said, hey, I think we know something, and that the two of you came out to your cars and were looking for bombs after to see if there was a car bomb or something. And so, yes. And you said...
I was driving a red Audi 5000 in those days, and we had ridden up there together and going back, and we did look.
Wow.
We did look because it turns out Mark set off all those bombs, but of course we couldn't have believed that. So for us, there was still somebody out there. And Mark's deception plan was working initially, but it only worked until he blew himself up. Because Steve Christensen...
Just one day,
basically. Right?
Yeah, Steve Christensen, that was the old... I've forgotten the name of the
judge building.
Well, he was at the judge building, but this all stemmed from his business dealings with Steve Christensen, and I'll think of the name of the business because he had been with Steve Christensen for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years before then.
CFS,
exactly. Kathleen Sheets, it's CFS. But then that night, there's a report about someone being seen in the judge building early in the morning, and he had on this leather jacket that was gray and green, and well, that didn't really fit. So then the next day, now Mark's blown up. Well, and I'll tell you, Kurt wasn't able to tell this, but I'll tell you the whole story here. The focus shifted to Mark within an hour of that bomb going off in his car. And this is the way that it happened. Since those bombs had gone off, the ATF had been called in because that's kind of their area of expertise. And that the car was sitting there on the hill behind the Deseret Gym. It had been on fire, not completely, but of course it was still kind of smoking a little bit and dripping and whatever. And when Mark had been blown up, he was laying in the street, and I'll give another little strange. This whole thing is just too weird. There were some people in the area that saw that happen. So several of them run over to him. There was a fellow by the last name of Christensen who saw that, went over, and his shirt, Mark's shirt, was torn a bit, and he could see garments. So he said, he knew the guy was a member. Pulled out a little vial of oil and gave him a blessing that he would live. Well, he did live. I'll let you all think about that one. He had enough presence of mind that by the time the ambulance gets there, they're questioning him. They said, what happened? And he had regained enough, like I say, presence of mind after having just suffered this explosion to say, a car hit me. A tan van was coming down the road, and the car hit me.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, the ambulance people and the initial police, so obviously he's traumatized, but he's concocted a story that doesn't fit. BATF comes, asks the police, who was it? It was this person. Where did you find him? Right here. What was the position? Da 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 da. And then said, I'm sorry. He told that van story later. What he told the police was there was a bomb in the car, and he said it was over on the passenger seat or something. Well, they told the BATF guy that. He looked at that bomb damage, and he said, that's the bomber right there. Because he knew instantly that his story and the evidence did not match. That's all they had to go on. But at that turned the focus that quickly. From that point, they exercised faith in the classy Hebrews definition. They looked for evidence of things hoped for, assurances of things not seen. And so then he was taken to LDS Hospital, put in under a false name, and spent, you know, I don't know, a week or 2 weeks or something.
Now, why was he put in as a false name?
Anybody that comes into those hospital systems that are of a notorious nature, whether it's by crime or they're famous or something, are put under a false name.
Was he famous then? I mean, in the Mormon community.
Big crime.
But it was just a big crime.
Big crime.
Okay, so that's why they did that.
Well, the hospital takes for an assumed that he was not the perpetrator but a victim. And so they don't want to give the perpetrator another chance to finish the job.
Oh, I see. That makes sense. Now, one of the other interesting things that you told me about was that Mark was able to pass a polygraph test. Mm-hmm. How was he able to do that?
Okay. Well, this is the way he was able to do it. He was examined by some of the premier polygraphers in the United States. And it was one of the fellows was from that actually administered the test was from the University of Utah. And it turns out that when that test is given, there's a paper recording goes on. And so the important part for determining if a person's truthful or not is not sitting at the test, but it's reading the chart. And so then, and examiners will all the time have other people that were not present in the test read the chart, so they're kind of coming at it fresh. So they're not being biased by what they saw or anything. They're just looking at the chart. Well, in his particular instance, it was done by a very competent examiner, and then it was read by five other well-known examiners, and they all declared that he was truthful. But the way that particular polygraph works is, it isn't like true or false. I mean, what you see on TV is a bunch of hooey. All it does is tests physical responses under stress to questions. And a good examiner will get the person really stressful so that they react strongly physically when they're telling an untruth. And when you hear about the sweating, that galvanic skin response, that's one of them. They will test for that. They'll test your breathing rate. They'll test your pulse. When I had mine, there were six different indicators going on. When Mark did his, it was just four because it was being done remotely. I mean, the way he was able to beat the polygraph, he had very competent examinations and reads, and they all showed him to be telling the truth. The way that those polygraphs work is they work on what is known as a zero null system. So in other words, they put up a scale and zero is the center, and then it goes -1, -2, -3, -4, you know, all the way -15, whatever, and then +1, +2, +3, whatever. And so when a test is scored, they will give a number, but the number will be +1 or -3 or +10. And generally, between -5 and +5 is a no reading. They can't tell. The person has been messing with the test, or the examination wasn't done well, or that they can't tell, so it'll be towards the center of that. But then when you get to -10, -11, -12, very untruthful and easily seen. +10, +12, +15. Very truthful. Mark scored a +14. Wow. I scored a +12. That really bothered those examiners. When they find out that he had beat that test, it really bothered them. And so it turns out that the main person up at the University of Utah, David Raskin, was able to arrange an interview with Mark when he was in prison, about 2 years. year and a half or 2 years afterwards, because he wanted to find out how in the world he was able to do that. And this is what Mark told him, and he said, Mark presented as very happy, you know, not, I mean, happy as you can be in prison, but, you know, a normal person, and didn't present with, as I mentioned, with a lot of psychological problems, and but he said that he did have a very unique ability. And that is, when he was about 13, he went to see a show where there was a hypnotist. And I remember it in Salt Lake. Ravine, maybe, was his name. I don't know. Maybe some of the listeners will know who this is. But he would come and kind of do shows, Saturday, you know, matinee shows and stuff. And that sparked a real interest in him. And he pursued that for the rest of his life and still does, where he has learned techniques of biofeedback, relaxation, and
hypnosis?
And self-hypnosis. And so he told David Raskin that basically what he did was, and evidently through the questions that David asked, well, how does this work and how does this work? He was convinced that he really does know how to hypnotize himself. He wasn't just saying that, because he was able to describe the procedures correctly. He was able to describe how he's able to control, you know, his physical responses. And so David believed that he really can do this. And I guess he did some investigation, because at one point, and Mark told me this some years later, that he was actually able to go to the dentist in prison, have a root canal done with no anesthesia.
Wow.
Biofeedback, relaxation. And he told David Raskin that he had had dental procedures. And he says he was conscious of what was going on, but just had learned to block the pain. So he hypnotized himself the night before the polygraph, and then again in the morning, and just told himself over and over again, I didn't do it, I didn't do it, I didn't do it. And then describes the test being administered, and when they got to the questions, did you cause the death of Kathleen Sheets, did you cause the death of Steve Christensen, you know, and there's only a small number of questions. Again, on movies and TV, this long line of questions, that's not the way it works. He was able to not produce any significant physical response to that, and said that he was aware of the questions, but could just let his subconscious come forward that he had convinced hadn't done it.
That's amazing.
David now believes that his tests are still just as valid, but he believes they're now, and he says, because 95% of polygraphs are used for criminal matters, and he says there's almost no criminals are going to go through that effort. But he says there is now a category that there is a potential problem in, and that is with spies, because they would have the sophistication and the knowledge base to learn self-hypnosis, and that could really become a problem, because in organizations like the CIA, FBI, they routinely use polygraphs to make sure everything's kosher in the system. Well, they would have to now be aware that there's possibility that some of those people that are working as an agent or whatever, or, you know, captured people that have come over from a different country, have learned those techniques, and those polygraphs may not be valid on them.
Wow, that's amazing. So is that why they don't use polygraphs in court as evidence?
No, they don't, because those things are still too unreliable. And they're just unreliable in that there's still that center section that if you were scored a plus one or a minus two, it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't tell if you're truthful or not. And so it that comprises a large enough segment of the polygraphs that it just makes them, you know, non-usable. And there's a lot of people in the legal profession that still have real problems with, because when you're entering that as verifiable testimony, you've got to, you've got to kind of be more sure than that. But like I say, I mean, those things are, and I think when David Raskin says that they're accurate, that doesn't mean that they can always tell truth or not, because there's going to be some in the middles. But what they're saying are is where they do get the very high plus ratings or the very low minus ratings, those are 90 or 95% accurate all the time.
Shannon Flynn gives his thoughts on what he thinks about Mark Hoffman.
He's of no value. The world does not need him. He can, even if he could contribute something, you know. I know there's some people who are kind of bleeding hearts. Oh, he could become a contributing man. We don't need him. He needs to spend the rest of his life in jail. He needs to go out there. And however it happened, and I actually, no, I have no ill will toward him. I mean, I don't want to go throw rocks at him or try to hurt him or something, but he needs to stay there. And actually, a lot of people, again, get confused, I think, because they think, oh, he got off easy. He got off bad. Because he went in at 30 or 32, which means that logically he will spend 50 or 60 years. And prison's not a good place. People say, oh, it's a country club. It's not a country club. So he gets to think about what he did for the rest of his life. And it's bad enough out there that he tried to commit suicide at least once and almost succeeded.
Do you remember the details around that?
Sure. He was out in maximum security. That was as a punitive measure. And he had collected sleeping pills from other inmates. They have a whole network of stuff that passes around in there. And so he collected sleeping pills. And he took everything that he had. But it was insufficient to kill him, because he took those and then went all night. And then he was, you know, he was in very poor shape. But then as the guards came around, someone noticed, you know, that he hadn't moved. And so they went in, and so then he was rushed over the infirmary and his stomach was pumped or whatever, I don't know. But then he was saved. So had he had more pills or been able to go longer, he may have succeeded. But it did damage him physically quite badly, because the way he had laid on top of, and I can't remember which arm it is. Physically, he is not in great shape these days, because from the bombing, he had a severe injury to one of his knees. He's missing kind of part of the fingers on one hand, where he flipped that thing over. There was a lot of damage to one of the arms, and then, you know, he has some scars around. And then from laying there, he had laid on his arm, and you know what it's like when you know, when your arm goes to sleep or your hand goes to sleep and it hurts and you wake up, you know, it hurts real bad. Well, of course, he never woke up. And so it wrecked the tissue on one of his hands and arms quite badly. And so when you see him, one arm is, there's scars, but one arm's all real skinny, because he lost quite a bit of the flesh off that hand as a result.
I know in the book Salamander, one of the policemen or detectives, I'm not sure which, said that the hand that did the forging has been permanently damaged.
That may be. Yeah. That may be. That's curiosity. I wonder if it would make any difference. I don't know.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Shannon Flynn. Shannon, we miss you, and you're it's a huge loss to the Mormon historians community that you're no longer with us. Appreciate the friendship that we had, and wish your family well, especially your wife, Robin. So God bless your family. In our next conversation, we're going to talk about Will Bagley. He may have been short in stature, but he was a giant in the Mormon historians community.
Making books is all I ever wanted to do, and I expect to keep doing it until I can do it no more.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please subscribe for just $5 a month at patreon.com gospeltangents, and you can hear the entire interview before everybody else. If you'd like to watch the entire video for just $8 a month, you can either subscribe on YouTube, Patreon, or my website, gospeltangents.com. Just click the yellow subscribe button, and I'll add you to our Gospel Tangents Insiders group so that you can see entire videos. For those interested in a PDF transcript, you can subscribe at either Patreon or on my website. For just $10 a month, I'll send you a PDF as soon as it's complete. If you'd like a copy of the paperback as well as a PDF, just sign up for $20 a month at either Patreon or my website, gospeltangents.com. Of course, you can buy individual transcripts at amazon.com and just do a search for Gospel Tangents Interview, and you can see all the things that we have there. Don't forget to support Gospel Tangents with an awesome t-shirt like one of these. You can subscribe at Apple Podcasts at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. Get our latest updates at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Also, you can get our Twitter updates at gospeltangents. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got more of our great videos. Thanks again.